and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. One of Mayor Johnson's former top staffers faced misconduct allegations before his departure. Our Spotlight Politics team unpacks the potential political fallout.
Two minced garlic cloves. That is some serious flavor you're putting in there.
I'm not joking.
The co-hosts of America's Test Kitchen join us to talk about their new cookbook and helpful hacks for holiday meals.
When you're cruising along one of Chicagoland's highways, what's on your mind?
And we've got a fun fact if you're hitting the road for the holiday this week. We explain how our highway system got its exit numbers. And now to some of today's top stories. A third day on the witness stand for former alderman-turned-FBI mole Danny Solis in the corruption trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Solis's testimony today centered on Madigan's alleged efforts to illegally steer business to his property tax firm amid efforts to develop land in Chinatown, which was in Solis's ward. But to do so, the state-owned land needed to be transferred to the city of Chicago so it could then be sold to developers, which Solis testified Madigan tried to keep secret from then-Governor Bruce Rauner. Madigan and his longtime confidant, Michael McLean, who is also facing charges, have pleaded not guilty. We'll have more on the trial with our Spotlight Politics team coming up soon. Voter turnout for the November 5th presidential election was Chicago's lowest of the last four presidential elections. The Chicago Board of Elections today proclaimed the final results, with nearly 68% of voters casting ballots, 45% of them on election day. Another 32% voted early and 22% voted by mail. More than 71% of voters turned out in Chicago for the last three presidential elections dating back to 2012. If you're planning to fly for the Thanksgiving holiday this week, it might be a bit more crowded at O'Hare. The Chicago Department of Aviation says the hub is expected to see a significant surge in passenger traffic, expecting an 11% increase compared to Thanksgiving last year. That's about 1.5 million travelers. While Midway traffic is expected to remain the same as last Thanksgiving, both airports will be at their busiest on Sunday, December 1st. And AAA predicts more than 71 million Americans will be traveling by car over Thanksgiving. The good news for them, though, gas prices are down about 20 cents per gallon compared to last Thanksgiving. And you can check out our website for tips to avoid congestion at O'Hare and Midway. Up next, our Spotlight Politics team on Mayor Johnson reversing course on proposed cuts to the budget. The whole team joins us right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Mayor Brandon Johnson made a big revision to the proposed budget, which may be an expensive consequence to the city and the future of Chicago Police Department. Meanwhile, the trial of Michael Madigan entered its sixth week with a new face, former 25th Ward Alderman and FBI mole Danny Solis. And a former senior staffer in Mayor Johnson's administration was facing misconduct accusations before his departure. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team, Amanda Vinicky, Heather Sharon, and Nick Blumberg. Hello again, everyone. Heather, let's start with you because you've done a great deal of reporting on this. Mayor Johnson reversing his initial proposal to cut 162 vacant CPD positions responsible for implementing the city's consent decree. Why did he reverse course here?
Well, it came on the heels of an investigation I worked on with ProPublica that found that really the city's efforts to comply with the consent decree are at a tipping point, with police reform advocates losing faith and the very real possibility that this reform effort will cost city taxpayer hundreds of millions of dollars for the foreseeable future. Hundreds of millions of dollars that the city does not have. But by the same token, the mayor was under significant pressure, not just from us in the news media, but also the attorney general, Kwame Ruhl, and the monitoring team charged with keeping track of the city's progress, that warned if those cuts were ratified by the city council, it would have been a death knell for those reform efforts, because as you said, it would have cut 162 vacant positions from the city's reform efforts and really reduced the city's ability to train officers on all of these new policies that they have spent so long developing to ensure that the police department no longer routinely violates the constitutional rights of Black and Latino Chicagoans. So he really had no choice. I think the larger question that I really don't know the answer to is, why were these in the budget to begin with? Why was this even a possibility? And how are the city going to, how is the city now going to restore those cuts and pay for them, which could cost as much as $24 million, which the city, again, does not have?
And we're going to find the people to fill 162 positions, because if they are vacant and now you're going to fill them and obviously pay those folks, that's hopefully a lot of work to get done.
It is.
My other question is, why are they vacant for so long
if
we need them?
And these positions have been consistently hard to fill because they do tend to be offered at a lower pay rate than sort of other of sworn police officer positions. But that means that you're competing for people within a still tight labor market doing very specialized work with very specialized sort of requirements. These positions are critical to the city, but can the city even fill them if they are budgeted for, I think, is a real question.
Heather, something that you mentioned. So the average cost of a Chicago Police Department officer is average, of course, $150,000 annually, including benefits. And so, as you've said, restoring these 162 positions to the city's spending plan could swell the city's budget gap by more than $24 million, complicating efforts to reach a budget agreement by the deadline, which is December 31st. Where does this put that effort?
It is a really difficult problem, and it is getting more difficult seemingly every day. So we know that the city council has refused to raise property taxes by $300 million. Now, Mayor Johnson last week said, okay, well, how about $150 million? And all of my reporting from every elder person I've talked to has said basically no, which
still
means
still,
there,
yeah,
right?
Still no.
Try again.
Yeah.
Now, and there's some concern that a law that did not get passed in the veto session will make it difficult for the city to collect taxes that they were expecting on cell phones. So that opens up a little bit more of a deficit. And you have older people who are really frustrated that there's really nothing in this budget that they can take back to their constituents and say, look, we're going to do this great thing, because there's no money and it costs money to do good things. So the older people are saying, look, if you're going to ask me to take this really unpopular vote, you got to give me something to give to the people back in my ward. It's not clear how any of that comes clear. Now, there have been no budget hearings this week. Everybody is off for the Thanksgiving holiday, which means that once everybody comes back to work on Monday, they are only going to have 29 days to figure out this deal. And of course, there's a little holiday called Christmas in the middle of that.
Heard of it. Be grateful while you have that short break.
Yeah, be grateful for the break. So, Amanda, former 25th Ward Alderman Danny Solis testifying in ex-Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan's corruption trial. As a reminder, Madigan has been indicted on federal racketeering and bribery charges. What did Solis have to say?
And Madigan, by the way, also a reminder, pleading not guilty to this. He says he did nothing wrong. The reporting on this has been that, you know, thus far, a lot of this was a repeat, really, of the so-called ComEd 4. But this is what I've seen described several times as popcorn viewing for political insiders. As in, you know, grab
your
snack and enjoy. Yum. And what you have had happen in court is that you're being able to see in cases Madigan looking stern is how he's been described. That is not surprising. Is he's in conversations with these apparent clients, really hookups that he got through Alderman Solis in what is seen as a trading of favors, or as you also had the jury saw and heard described as a quid pro quo. I mean, you had Solis saying that twice, literally those words. He says that this is not something that the FBI pressured him to do, even though, of course, he knew that they were listening. So that is what you've really had play out, is this unveiling. He is the star witness. He was the FBI's inside guy. And through several schemes, the jury is being taken through these tales of how it was that Solis was working with Madigan to use Madigan's power as Speaker of the Illinois House, allegedly to bring in work to his law firm, in essence, to make money.
Nick, you know, as Amanda's mentioned, Solis has admitted to a slew of unethical behavior. Does this diminish his credibility on the stand?
I think that's the eternal question that a federal prosecutor has to ask themselves when they want to decide whether or not they're merely going to play the audio and video recordings that a mole like Solis helped them obtain, or whether they want to actually call that person to the stand. Because let's remember, the reason that Solis started working with the feds in the first place is because he was the head of the very powerful zoning committee in city council, and he was, you know, the FBI came to him and said, we've got all this evidence that you've been accepting bribes, that you've been accepting, you know, the free use of a ranch, you know, all sorts of, even
Viagra pills.
Yeah, right. Even right. more, Let's even more it. Unseemly
Massages,
things than that.
Some other
yeah,
stuff we're not going to say on family television.
You know, popcorn stuff there. Although maybe you might want to put the popcorn down for some of the details.
Yeah.
But you know,
so you don't, yeah.
yeah. So this is clearly someone who has reputational damage to contend with, and also, you know, depending on the jury member, they may or may not look kindly on somebody who flips on their colleagues there. Although certainly, I think they would try to weed those folks out during the jury selection process. But, you know, they kind of have to play this on a case-by-case basis. You know, Solis testified in the ComEd 4 case. In the Burke case,
they did...
Right, but yeah. he was testifying as a witness for the defense right. in the Burke case. You know, they brought him up there to say, you know, this is someone who is not a reliable narrator. So it's going to be a tough road, but he is a star witness here.
And I think what you have to keep in mind, again, is that you are hearing and seeing the video and the recordings, and that to me changes things. You might have perhaps an unsavory character, sure, but you're not trying to get beers and hang out or even elect a guy at this point.
Right.
He's no longer an elected official. So when you hear these things play out, that to me is what could be very striking for members of the jury.
Okay, so back to the mayor's office, because Heather, his former communications director, Ronnie Reese, recently coming under fire. What's he being accused of?
Well, he is accused of a slew of misogynistic and sexist and inappropriate behavior in the mayor's office. And we do know that he was the subject of these complaints and that they were found to be sustained and that he was recommended for additional training. It's not clear why he was allowed to keep his post after these complaints. Now, we can tell from the documents that we and a number of other news organizations obtained via the Freedom of Information Act that he did go through some sort of counseling or reprimand series with the mayor's chief of staff, Christina Passione Zayas. But we do know that she recommended a restorative justice procedure, and it's not clear how you can address complaints of misogyny and inappropriate behavior, and in one case, inappropriate touching at an after-work event with that sort of approach. So there are lots of questions about not only the mayor's decision to appoint Reese to this very important position, which gave him really authority over the mayor's sort of public-facing message, but also his inability to sort of make sure that the other employees in his office were in a safe and non-hostile work environment.
Yeah, I think it's pretty tough to try to employ something like a restorative justice circle, you know, as forward-thinking and progressive an idea as some folks might see that as, when there is such a power disparity between the two people involved. These are not peers here that are involved in the allegation. So that's a huge complication for
Correct.
Dealing with a problem like this.
Yeah.
A few seconds left, Heather, 30 maybe. possible political consequences for the mayor for this. And, you know, have they said anything publicly in response to all that's come out?
They have not. Now, the mayor had promised to hold weekly press conferences every Tuesday. We didn't get one today, perhaps because of the holiday, perhaps not. But I think, again, the question is, you know, the buck stopped with him. He wears the jacket for the people in his office. And if they, you know, made sort of infractions and he didn't hold them accountable, I think that's questions that taxpayers want to know, because all of these people were paid by taxpayer dollars.
As they are. All right. That is Spotlight. We're not paid by taxpayer dollars. Viewers like you. Amanda Vinicky, Heather Sharone, Nick Blumberg. Thanks, everybody. Up next, celebrating 25 seasons of America's Test Kitchen. With more than 600 episodes and millions of weekly viewers, America's Test Kitchen has become a household staple. And they're celebrating their 25th season with a new cookbook featuring just 500 of their most iconic recipes, just in time for the holidays. Here to talk more about their big milestone are co-hosts Julia Collin-Davison and Bridget Lancaster. Thanks to you both for joining us. It is good to have you here in the Chicago Tonight studio. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So first, I'm going to ask you both this. Why do you think the show has resonated with viewers for so long? Julia, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, I think the content, right? If you think about the food recipes that work, we taste test ingredients, so we tell you what to buy at the supermarket, how to spend your money, you know, where it's valuable, and then the equipment testing. So you can help outfit your kitchen without wasting money. And the whole idea is to empower home cooks. And I think we're able to do that really well.
Bridget?
Yeah, I also think that we have a connection with our viewers. It starts with the readers of our magazines and our cookbooks. They're really the ones that come up with the ideas of the food that we test and that eventually make it on the show. So I think that they feel like they're really a part of it from the very beginning.
You both started off as test cooks. And then you became, of course, the co-hosts of the show at the start of the 17th season.
Mm-hmm.
I know, right? And you were babies when you started.
We were.
What would you say are some of the most significant changes over the last, you know, over the years, Bridget?
Yeah, well, I mean, just becoming from going from being a test cook to host, I think, was such a huge leap for us. But it was really important for us to have that experience because now we're on the other side and we're getting to work with other people, getting to ask them the questions and having that experience behind us, knowing what people expect when you're cooking on camera, I think allows us to be better hosts.
Julia?
We also get to cook together, finally. Mm. And, I mean, we just have so much fun. We've been friends for 26 years.
1,000 years.
And the fact, and it's just fun. I mean, we have valuable things to teach people about how to cook, but we're having a good time, and I think, you know, that's the best part.
Julia, how do you decide, Bridget mentioned this, but how do you decide what to cook and what to test and how to test it?
Yeah, well, we ask our viewers and readers of our cookbooks and magazines, we poll them constantly, what's on their radar? What are they interested in? Is it the Mediterranean diet? Is it the air fryer? What are you into? What do you want to know about? And that's how we get our ideas, because we're not going to focus on things that don't resonate with the audience at this time.
And we know that food can go through trends and popularity. Bridget, the show can also get very sciencey. Why is that important?
It's so important. It really is everything about cooking. The science is, when you break down what cooking is, it's just a whole bunch of science happening in a kitchen. You get to eat that science. So if you know the why of what something's happening and not just how to cook it, you can become a great problem solver and really solve future cooking problems yourself, too.
It can make science delicious.
Yeah. It's the least we can do.
Instead of maybe scary. Mm-hmm. So to celebrate 25 seasons, as we've mentioned, you've published a new 25th anniversary cookbook with 500 recipes, just 500. Mm-hmm. How did you narrow it down to 500 recipes?
Yeah, that was hard to do.
It really was.
We have over 1,200 recipes that we've done on television, so getting that down to 500 required that we got feedback from our readers. Also, we wanted to look at what really resonated with our viewers. And, you know, we looked at new and future trends in cooking. And so we wanted to make sure that our recipes that we included were pretty contemporary, but we still have some classics in there.
Yeah, we also all got to choose our favorite recipes.
True.
And we get to write a little sidebar about that. And, of course, we cooked roast chicken, 10 times? We could only pick one. Mm. So we picked one that had the most modern, most interesting cooking method. Because after 25 years, you learn as you go. And maybe the first roast chicken, and it's good, but we have a new way to do it that's even better. So that kind of helped us along.
And I understand this cookbook, it has a lot of game-changing tips and tricks. I believe the modern-day term for that is hack.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite? Maybe with regards to the chicken, perhaps. Anything I ought to know?
Oh, I could talk to you about roast chicken for hours. I have gotten pulled off of TV.
She will talk
I
to you.
I will. There's a weeknight roast chicken where you turn the oven off partway through, and it is brilliant. The chicken comes out perfectly juicy.
Okay, this is good to know. Turn the oven off.
Turn the oven off.
You're probably going to want to read the recipe, though, before you just turn the oven off.
Yeah, a little more of that.
Yeah. Bridget, anything that you all have tested that has been just a total flop, big disaster?
There's a couple I can think of. One of them was candy. It was a fudge. It was awful. It took years and years and years to try to make it so that the home cooks could do it and replicate it reliably, but that just didn't turn out well. In fact, the test cook was responsible for that. Had his shoulder thrown out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, rotator cuff injury and everything.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, gosh.
But we do have a more modern recipe. We've been working on French macaron for years. Mm. And this year,
after Steve, one of our colleagues, developed a brilliant recipe for it. I got to cook it with Julia on camera.
Yeah, after 25 years, we got the recipe right.
It only took 25 years. All right, so we got to stay tuned for that one to find out how it goes. Cookbook also has, of course, you know, top classic Thanksgiving recipes, but also some interesting twists. What would you say is one of the most sort of exciting twists that a home cook can try in their kitchen this year?
Well, pulling out your pizza stone, putting it in the oven when you roast the turkey. Game changer. It evens the oven heat, it browns the chicken from the bottom, cooks it through, and that's the dark meat. That's the dark meat that is slower to cook than the white meat, so you get a more evenly cooked turkey.
Okay, I should probably purchase a pizza stone.
Step
one, buy pizza stone. Got it. Just write that down. And you all have also been known to do a new turkey recipe every year. Do you have any favorites?
Well, that one is actually one of my favorites, but there's a new butterflied turkey. So it's cut, you take out the backbone and you make it flat so it all cooks nice and evenly. And all the juices go into the stuffing, and it just makes everything taste so good. So that's beautiful, too.
Of course, you've mentioned the home cook because, you know, the show emphasizes communicating with the home cook. How would you say they've changed over 25 years?
Yeah, I mean, supermarkets have changed, right? The supermarket of today is not the supermarket of 20 years ago. There's so many more options, so many more ingredients, and helping people learn how to use those and make different ethnic recipes, that's what people want to know today, and so that's what we're really focusing on.
Bridget?
Yeah, I think they're more curious maybe than they were years ago. At least I think that they get on the bandwagon of wanting something new, and that's really exciting because people aren't just getting stuck into the same recipes over and over again, willing to try new things.
I'd say they also have they've got a lot of folks to choose from, right? Like, there's so much access now to food and cooking and content. Sounds like they stick with you, though.
Yeah. Well, our recipes work because we test them anywhere from 30 to 50 times before we publish them or put them on TV. We also send them out to groups of around the country. We have about 70,000 people that cook recipes for us before we publish them because we can make anything work in the test kitchen, but the value of our recipe is whether people can make them at home. And the only way to test that is to have home cooks do that. We do that to every recipe before we put it on TV.
All right, so we know it's been through the ringer.
Yeah, sure.
All right, it's been a pleasure to speak with both of you, Julia Collin-Davidson and Bridget Lancaster. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can visit our website for a special holiday recipe. That is at WTTW.com/news. And while you're there, you can also check out the new season of America's Test Kitchen. We're right back after this. If you're one of the many travelers hitting the road this week for Thanksgiving, we've got some interesting facts for you to spice up your road trip conversation. While expressways may not always be that express, they do contain some useful information you might not be aware of when you're on the road. Here's Nick Blumberg to explain how our interstate exits are numbered.
When you're cruising along one of Chicagoland's highways, what's on your mind? What song to play next? Where the nearest burger place is? When all this construction will be finished? Do you ever find yourself wondering how all the exits got their numbers? It's relatively simple, but not necessarily intuitive. For interstates in Illinois that run north-south, like I-55, the numbering system starts at the southernmost point the highway enters Illinois. For interstates running east-west, like I-80, the numbers start at the westernmost point. A lot of times, the very first turnoff is exit 1, but the next one isn't necessarily going to be exit 2. That's because the numbers correspond not to how many exits there are, but to how many miles away from the border they are. So by following the exit sign numbers, you can actually track how far you are from the state's boundary line. Sometimes things get a little tricky. Where two interstates merge, the numbering system for one supersedes the other. For example, if you're heading downtown along I-90 where it meets I-94, the exit numbers jump from 84 down to 44. Which brings us to one more wrinkle in the system. Around the city, I-90, that's the Skyway, Dan Ryan, Kennedy, and Jane Addams, and I-94, or the Kingery, Bishop Ford, Dan Ryan, Kennedy, Edens, and the Tri-State Tollway, mostly run north and south. But the signs all say east and west. What gives? Well, don't forget about the interpart of interstates. Our highways are part of a nationwide system, and 90 and 94 broadly run east-west across the country. They've just got to curve around pesky old Lake Michigan to carry on their merry way, so they move north-south through the Windy City. So the next time you find yourself stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic, you may not know how long you'll be sitting there, but at least you'll know how far your bumper is from the border.
And you can see more from our WTTW News Explained series on our website. While you're there, you can also find tips for reducing holiday travel stress. Just in time. That is our show for this Tuesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And you can also stay connected by following us on Blue Sky at WTTW. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Area business owners are looking for a bump in foot traffic now that the holidays are approaching. And a look at how local Native Americans are celebrating their heritage. And we leave you tonight with a frolicking sea otter pup named Seldovia, rescued last year and now living its best life at the Shedd Aquarium. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm committed to giving back to the community through law and philanthropy.